Okay, first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me for this very interesting meeting. Now, I have the problem that most of what I want to cover has already been covered yesterday by Christoph, Jim, and Ulrich, and so they had said most of it, but probably not all of it. So I will first half of my talk, I will put this discussion into a more general context, commenting on the magnetic fields in the early universe. And then in the second part, I will talk about these beam plasma instabilities. So if you have any question, don't hesitate to interrupt me if I'm unclear. So this is collaboration done with two former graduate students, Tim Felten and Ulf Menzler in Bochum, and two current graduate students, Ulrich and Stefan. Stefan were also here. And Peter Jon of the University of Maryland, who helped us a lot in the plasma physical aspects of this talk. And after a short introduction, which basically repeats what has been said yesterday, I will remind you of the known upper bounds on the extragalactic magnetic field, then this hotly debated subject on whether you can get lower bounds from gamma ray astronomy, from the pair production of blazar photons. Well, I think the question is not settled right now, but there's no question that there are extragalactic magnetic fields. We can calculate lower bounds from fluctuation theory, as Ulrich has shown yesterday to you, and we also have some ideas on how to get from the disordered field to ordered fields by compressing them later. So in the literature, you read very often that magnetic fields are generated and maintained by the dynamo action, where you transfer energy from the differential rotation of spiral galaxies into magnetic field energy. This is true. You also can have MHD instabilities, such as magnetorotational instabilities. You can also have kinetic plasma instabilities. We suggested some years ago, together with Padma Shukla, that the viable and filamentation instability might work. But these instabilities all need some sort of free energy in the form of anisotropic plasma particle distribution functions. And they also require, because all these mechanisms are only a mechanism of amplification, they need finite seed magnetic fields. So in all, whether you do dynamo theory or you do MHD instability theory or kinetic plasma instabilities, you always end up with some equation like this, where the change of the magnetic field energy is proportional to some growth rate times delta B squared. So this has just the simple exponential solution in the linear phase. But you need definitely some finite field at T equals zero to start from. And that field is provided by spontaneous emission. And if you don't have that, then none of these mechanisms will work. So it's very important to know how strong are the seed fields with which you can generate more stronger fields. Now, all this permanent ferromagnetism and so on that we use in our daily life to create magnetic fields, you can't use them because in the early universe we didn't have these materials. Now, so far, no extragalactic magnetic field has been detected. We only have upper limits and we have lower limits, but we do not have any detection. And the upper limits have been collected in this paper by Neronov and Semikos in Physical Review D. And they both refer to the strength of the magnetic field and also to the smallest scales and the largest scales that the magnetic fields can have. And from the cosmic microwave background radiation, you can infer that the extragalactic magnetic field has to be less than 10 to minus 9 Gauss. This is also the latest Planck results. They say, well, anything below 10 to the minus 9 Gauss is compatible with the observations. Now, then we have observations of galaxy clusters. We have Zeeman splitting. So they put an upper bound on the magnetic field strength. Now, then, in this very popular paper, I I mean, I went to a cosmologist conference in Stockholm, and they were always talking about this work. I mean, Neronov was really treated like a pope, so because he had provided them with a lower limit from magnetic fields using gamma ray astronomy. And the argument has been, so he was claiming in science that you could construct, depending on the scale of the magnetic field, you can construct lower limits on the cosmological magnetic field strength. Now, the argument, and this is just repeating what everybody has said yesterday, comes from the fact that these new Cherenkov TV gamma ray telescopes have detected about 30 cosmological blazars with strong TeV photon emission. And the most distant ones, as far as I know, are these PKS 1441 plus 25. There's, on YouTube, there's a very nice NASA movie. It's called Blazar Bonanza. I was thinking that I put this into my talk, and then I didn't do it. So that has a redshift of 0.939. And there's even one, the gravitational lensed quasar has an even higher redshift, set 0.944. Then there is this 3C279. And I just listed those with the highest redshift. And basically, what happened is this is the observed photon flux. This is an old picture from Hegra, even. And this is what is thought is the intrinsic TV gamma ray flux that comes from the source, and all this has been absorbed by gamma-gamma production. So if you take a blazar at very high redshift, what happens is, so you have this beam emission towards you, and the photons that propagate in this beam direction, they undergo double photon collisions with the photons from the EBL background, which have about 0.1 eV. This happens if there's a kinematic threshold. It's the product of the TV photons times the EBL energy is greater than MEC squared C4. So this is 5.11 10 to the 5 squared. So therefore, the EBL is more important for the spare production because the mean energy of the microwave background radiation would be 0.3 eV. So that would require an even higher energy for the incoming gamma ray photon to pair produce. So this has a mean free path of about 80 megaparsecs, this process, at 10 TeV. And if you translate that, it means that any quasar that is more distant as 0.018, the TeV photons are absorbed. In this old paper, I made a mistake here. I said any blazar that has a redshift greater than 0.16 undergoes this, but I think this is a factor of 10 smaller. So these photons would not reach us. So these TeV photons are translated into energetic pairs. And then, of course, the question is, what are these pairs doing? And they are borne out with Lorentz factors of 10 to the 6. I scale everything with this Lorentz factor. And they could make, basically, in the same range, they would inverse Compton scatter the microwave background radiation on this time scale. And this does not take into account that should be even smaller because you have a beamed pair that goes through the interstellar medium. And then these photons, these inverse Compton photons, are still energetic enough for pair production. And then you would develop a whole electromagnetic cascade as in vacuum. Now, this is all fine, but the problem was that these inverse Compton gamma rays have not been detected by the Fermi satellite. And therefore, Neronov and Vogt argued that you need some strong enough stochastic extragalactic magnetic field that would scatter these pairs out of the way of the observers, and we would not see them, and everything would be fine. Now, Christoph summarized all the problems with these observations. There could be a problem with the background, because for a single object, the pairs are deflected and out of our line of sight, but there are other blazars that eventually point into another direction. And if they are deflected, they would get into our line of sight. So you don't win anything. So you still have a problem with the extragalactic gamma ray background. And then these three gentlemen here suggested a new interpretation that you use these pair energies not for inverse quantum scattering, but that you transfer the energy by some other means, and therefore the inverse quantum emission would be less. you can calculate. Wait, not reacting. You could calculate by using reactive and kinetic instability analysis. You could show that this created pair beam distribution function is quickly unstable to the generation of various instabilities like electrostatic oscillations. These growth times are much shorter than these inverse Compton time scale, and therefore less energy is available for for the electrons to scatter, to interact by inverse Compton scattering. Basically, what happens if these electrostatic, I think I skipped one slide. Terrible. I want page 11. Yeah. It's there? Okay. Now, from the kinematics of the gamma-gamma collision, you can calculate the pair production spectrum. And this is what we did in this paper here. It had also been calculated by other people, but by Aharonian et al. And Bonometto and Rees in other contexts. But this is basically the production spectrum of pairs that you get. And one curve is an analytical calculation, and the other one is a Monte Carlo simulation by Andriy Aliyev. And so we get really pretty good agreement. And the interesting thing, this is a plotted as a function of the parallel momentum of particles in units of 10 to the 10 MeC squared. And what's interesting is that you have this positive gradient here in the pair production spectrum. So you have an energy inversion. So you have more particles at higher energies than at lower energies. And nature doesn't like that. It's like an emazer. If you have a, if you have more particles in a higher energy state, then the system reacts by additionally induced emission to the spontaneous emission as long as this gradient is removed. And this is exactly what this instability does. So if this instability has proceeded for a long enough time, this initially an energy inversion develops into something which is flat. Df by d parallel is zero. We call this a plateau distribution. So at the end of this instability, you have a flat distribution function. Antoine would call this a waterbag, I think. And so the final distribution functions after full relaxation to this instability looks like this, because it's a plateauing. So the number of particles has to be the same. So you just redistribute them in energy. No particles get lost. So the area under these curves has to be the same. And then you get this plateau distribution instead of this inverted distribution. Now it turns out that the total energy is 50%. And this plateau distribution is 50% of the total energy that is in this initial pair production spectrum. And that means that the inverse Compton yield is reduced. It's basically reduced by 10% for full plateauing. So you redistribute your pair energy. Now this does not take, this does not happen on the time scale of creating the instability. It typically happens on time scales 100 times the, as we know from numerical simulation of non-relativistic plasma system. It takes 100 times to react on the full population. It's like a disease. If the first if you infect the society with the disease, some virus, it takes some time until the whole society is infected. This is typically about 100 times the growth rate when you first create the electrostatic fluctuations. So the argument is that this relaxation, this plateauing, is quicker than it takes for the particles to do inverse quantum scattering. And then you reduce the signal in inverse quantum scattering. And we did this a little bit more careful with Ulf Menzler. And now this is the... I hope that with CTA we will get better observational evidence for this effect. So this is the observed TEV spectrum. Now you correct for gamma-gamma absorption, so you argue this is the intrinsic spectrum. Now if you use this one and make the spare production and then calculate the inverse Compton signal, it's this. And this is this discrepancy that Nironov and Vogt are arguing about. I mean, this is a factor two, right? I mean, it's just one data point. So I always thought it's not a big deal. But I was surprised. Everybody jumped on it. So now this is without plateauing. Now, if you do a plateau just in parallel direction, you reduce your signal to this in agreement with the Fermi observations. If you also then, by transverse instabilities, isotropize the particle distribution functions, you can even get it down much lower, so isotropized plateau. So this is the observational evidence we have. But there are lots of questions. I mean, this might not be the only intrinsic spectrum that you construct from the observations. You just play around with your optical depths of the EBL. I'm sure you can make this a little bit going down, and then the data would be OK. So I think this is really pushing the data. So we definitely need better observations of this effect than we have right now. Maybe we will hear more about it in the talk on the Fermi people. And now then, you use most of this generated oscillation energy to heat the IGM, and you are more experts than I am, so you change the thermal history. This has all been pointed out, that can change the formation of cosmic structures. But in the context with magnetic fields, I think, most importantly, there is no need to require the existence of small intergalactic magnetic field to scatter the produced pairs. We can also understand the discrepancy with Fermi by these plasma effects. But I'm not arguing against magnetic fields. Quite to the contrary, I believe that there are turbulent intergalactic magnetic fields. But the limits of Nironov and Vogt definitely have to be modified due to the pair production instability. It should not take their derived limits as a final word on it. There's definitely more work needed, and I will come to that. Come back to this at the end of the talk. So we have to consider partial versus full plateauing. We have to think about whether there are mechanisms to stabilize the beam, like in a disease. If you don't do anything, then the affected people will infect other people. But if you lock them away under quarantine, then they can't do it, and therefore you prevent the whole society from getting infected. That's the same thing that you do here. You generate the waves, but if you do something with the waves so that they cannot work back on the particles, then this instability will be prolonged. So like this nonlinear Landau damping that Phil talked about, the waves do something else. They do not work back on the particles that created them, and therefore the saturation timescale, the plateauing timescale, will get prolonged. There also have been discussion that you have a small and finite spread in the perpendicular direction that may slow down the instability. So there's still a lot of things to do to work on this process of plateauing. Now let's. I will briefly repeat what Ulrich has said yesterday. Now, from theory, we could calculate some lower bounds on the magnetic field strength. And what you have to realize is that after reionization, redshift 20 or redshift 14, I don't know, you have a fully ionized or partially ionized intergalactic gas consisting of protons, electrons, helium, and they have a temperature of about 10 to the 4 Kelvin. And therefore, this means that all quantities have fluctuations due to this, to the random thermal motion of these particles. And you could calculate the dispersion or deviation from the average value using this thermal motion of the particles, this random motion. In particular, it means that you have a mean value of the density with fluctuations around it, you have a pressure mean value with fluctuations around it, but you can also have electric and magnetic field fluctuations, although the average electric field and magnetic field is zero. And we calculated this small but finite dispersion of magnetic field due to this thermal motion. Now the fluctuations, you make you describe them as superposition of plane waves, so you have a real wave vector and a complex frequency, so each fluctuating magnetic field has this spatial structure. Superposition of monochromatic waves, we all know that from electrodynamics. And one distinguishes between collective modes, where the frequency is a function of the wave number. The most famous one are these electromagnetic waves, where the dispersion relation is omega r squared is c squared k squared. And they are not damped, so the imaginary part of gamma is zero. If you look at the time dependence of this equation here, so this is just an oscillation behavior, cosine, sine with a phase speed. But if gamma is positive, these fluctuations grow in time. You have a growing, you have an instability. If gamma is negative, these fluctuations damp in time. So in vacuum, gamma is always zero. Now, if you go to a plasma, gamma can be different from zero. So, but there are also non-collective modes where such a dispersion relation does not exist, and omega and k are just very independently from each other. Now, regarding frequency, the real imaginary part of frequency, we normally distinguish between weakly damped wave-like modes, where the imaginary part is much smaller than omega r, but you can also have the opposite of weakly propagating modes, where omega r is much less than gamma. This would even include aperiodic fluctuations, where the real part of the frequency is zero. And Erich Weibel was the first guy in 1959 who pointed out that you could have such aperiodic fluctuations. So these fluctuations do not propagate because their real part is zero, the phase speed is zero. So they just stand there, they oscillate in space, but they do not propagate. So there's no question, I mean, this is not something that theorists have thought about. These fluctuations really exist in nature. In situ plasma turbulence observations in the interplanetary medium show that they are full with aperiodic fluctuations. So they call them mirror modes or fire hose modes or the ordinary mode oscillation. So there's no doubt that these aperiodic fluctuations or weakly propagating fluctuations consist in nature. So just to sketch this, so this would be a weakly amplified or weakly damped wave. So this is sine or cosine. At one time, it looks like this. And at a later time, it's propagated to the right. If gamma is greater than zero, the amplitude becomes larger. This is the same plot if you have a damped wave. So they propagate to the right, and the amplitude gets smaller. Now, if you sketch a weakly propagating wave, it does the same thing, but it hardly propagates because omega r is very close to zero, a damped one, an amplified one. And if omega r is zero, if you have an aperiodic wave, they just oscillate in space, but they do not propagate at all. So they grow in time or they damp in time. This is what a physical picture for an aperiodic fluctuation. Now, in the literature, people have worked out the level of fluctuations mainly by only for weakly amplified or damped modes, going back to Ed Salpeter, and then the Russians here, Ishimaru, the German Bock on this. So if you have a weakly damped mode, you could calculate from fluctuation theory what the level of fluctuations that you get. And only together with Peter, we also formulated the theory for weakly propagating waves or aperiodic waves, which not just not existing. Now you can do this for any isotropic distribution function, whether it's magnetized or unmagnetized. But in the particular case where all plasma species are thermal plasmas, and if they all have equal temperature, same temperature for electrons than for protons, you can even use the fluctuation dissipation theorem for these plasmas. And we calculated this for general, for arbitrary complex frequencies, not just for weakly damped fluctuations together with Ulrich. And this is the expression that you get, which has something to do with the temperature, energy in the temporal field. And then it involves this thermal transverse dispersion function it's a long equation. It's just normally this dispersion function. If the determinant of omega t is zero, then you would get the dispersion relation. That gives you the fluctuations, the non-collective fluctuations, as a function of wave number and of frequency. And if you do this with aperiodic noise, this is the thermal aperiodic noise of the universe in the IGM. So this is how it looks like. So you can have, this is frequency, gamma can be positive, negative. This is the wave number, and this is what you get from a thermal distribution. And what we found is we found a new collective mode, which is shown here. So this is a contour plot in powers of E. So you see most of these fluctuations are associated with this red band here, which is a new mode. And here I have to contradict Antoine. If you have an unmagnetized plasmas, there are not many modes. You just have the electrostatic waves, longitudinal modes, but there was no known transverse mode in an unmagnetized plasma. This is the only one that exists. It's a damped aperiodic mode. And I think this is a very important discovery that an unmagnetized plasma has these damped modes here. And most of the intensities are concentrated in this damped mode. So the damped mode is characterized by the fact that the thermal dispersion function is exactly zero. So this is zero. So you have to be careful. If you divide by zero, this becomes very large. So you have to expand the thermal dispersion function around the zero in order to find out the contribution from the damped mode. And this is what we did. And then we would get for the collective fluctuations, this would be the delta B squared in equilibrium. Equilibrium does not hold at very small k. This is the generalized Kirchhoff's law that Ulrich talked about. The equilibrium spectrum only holds at wave numbers greater than some characteristic value, and that corresponds to a maximum spatial scale given by this in centimeters or in megaparsecs, 10 to the minus 10 megaparsecs. So for lambda smaller than 10 to the minus 10 megaparsecs, this is a scaling with temperature and density, temperature in units of 10 to the 4, density in units of 10 to the minus 7. And then you would have the spectrum, the wave number spectrum, as a function of k of collective fluctuations. And then you can integrate over all k. And then you find for present day values that you get out a magnetic field strength of about 6 times 10 to the minus 18 Gauss. And if we then use these scalings, that the density goes up as 1 plus Z, and the temperature goes up as 1 plus Z. And if we take this to Z equal 20, which is probably a little bit large, for a fully reionized universe, we would create about 10 to the minus 14 Gauss in random fluctuations, aperiodic fluctuations. And these fields are guaranteed. You can't get rid of them. If you assume a thermal distribution of your plasma, you have to have them. And they have 100% volume factor. They are everywhere where you have a fully ionized gas, which is a big advantage of the Spearman battery process, which has very tiny volume filling factors. And it's also much larger, five orders of magnitude larger than what the Spearman battery process would give us. And also, as Ulrich mentioned, people discussed some cosmological phase transitions that also would generate 10 to the minus 20 Gauss. So we think we have discovered a new mechanism for creating cosmological seed fields, a new primary dyno mechanism. And these seed fields then serve as seeds for further instabilities if some some free energy is available. If you have an anisotropic particle distribution function, if you then you just amplify these seed magnetic fields. Good. Yeah, this is just stronger than the Biermann battery process, stronger than this one, and the nice thing, it has very high volume filling factors. So these are at very small scales. But if you then compress them and stretch them, you can make the scales much stronger. And this is, if you would work out what the plasma beta is in this, the ratio of the pressure in these random magnetic fields to the thermal pressure, it is very small, 10 to the minus 15. So these magnetic fields just do what the gas does. So you could, if you compress your gas, then the magnetic fields get also compressed. So we illustrated this. Let's assume we have five early protostars here, sitting here, and there's a random magnetic field in here. If now one of these protostars explodes in the form of a supernova, then it will just compress these magnetic fields and stretch and order them, and you make then an ordered magnetic field out of it. And this has been, in other contexts, also done more carefully, analytical considerations, numerical simulations by Liang and Peter Scheuer. If you put shear or you compress this IGM, you can enormously amplify these seed magnetic fields and make them isotropic. So depending on the kind of compression you put to this, you can even get one-dimensional ordered magnetic field strength be created out of these originally fully random tangled magnetic fields. Now this goes on until the plasma beta value becomes one, and then you have to worry about the magnetic restoring force that the magnetic fields have. Then also the magnetic fields influence the dynamics of the IGM, and not that these are passively tied to hydrodynamics. So I think this probably might explain how you would get from turbulent fields to ordered fields. Now this compression will not happen everywhere in the galactic medium, only in regions that are overrun frequently by shocks and winds. And you probably need many compressions to create an ordered magnetic field. Okay, now to summarize this first part, I mentioned that no magnetic extragalactic magnetic field has been detected. There are upper limits, and well, there are various lower bounds that have been proposed. I think that the lower bounds from gamma ray astronomy, this Neronov and Volk lower bounds, need to be modified due to the pair beam instability argument, which offers a different explanation to the Fermi non-detection. Instead of that, we created a new lower bound set by plasma fluctuation theory, which is about magnetic fields of 10 to the minus 14 Gauss at small scales at redshift of 10 to the 20. And these serve well as cosmological seed fields for further amplification processes once you have a source of free energy available. And now let's, in the remaining time, how much time do I have? Okay, that should be enough. So let's now discuss a little bit what happens once you have created this pair beam. What will happen to it? And in fact, in other contexts, we looked into this. So if you neglect spatial dependencies, so you take a homogeneous source, the time-dependent behavior of the excited electrostatic waves, and I will just, for this discussion, refer to parallel electrostatic waves, is determined by this weak turbulence kinetic equation. Weak turbulence plasma theory still means that we can identify individual modes, like the electrostatic or Langmuir mode. So it changes by being created in instability if the growth rate is positive. But as I've just argued, they could also be spontaneously emitted by the thermal plasma, which is there. They can get Landau damped by interacting with the background gas. So there's a Landau damping rate here. And they can interact with wave interactions. So there could be other waves, like these ion sound waves, this transverse limitation of viable modes. And in principle, if you would know the intensities of this, and you would know the wave-wave interaction cross-section, so to say, you could also change them by these by interacting with other waves. Now, and the other waves will also have a similar kinetic equation. So for every mode that you identify, you will have a couple of wave equations. And we just look now on the electrostatic wave equation. Now red, this is called the quasi-linear approach. You don't worry about spontaneous emission. You don't worry about Landau damping. You don't worry about wave-particle interaction. You're just looking at these two red points here, that the intensity of the waves is changing by the growth rate. Now, the growth rate for parallel fluctuations is this expression here. If you have a pair beam, you sum over the plasma frequency of the pairs, negatron and positron. You integrate over all momentum. Gamma is the Lorentz factor of the particles. And then it's basically the gradient df by dp parallel. So if this is positive, if you have a momentum inversion, then you have this Mayser effect, and your growth rate will be positive. If this is inverted, if you will have damping, and if this is a plateau, dfj by dp parallel is zero, there will be no effect anymore. Very simple. And this is a resonance condition from Cherenkov resonance. So you interact resonantly if k times v parallel equals the real part of the frequency. And I've just expressed v parallel as p parallel over gamma. And you have to do it relativistically. So gamma is not 1. If you do it non-relativistically, gamma is 1, and then you can separate the parallel integration from the perpendicular one. It becomes much easier. But in the real case, you have to do it like this. And at time 0, the waves are due to spontaneous emission. And we also calculated that. So this is the same plot as for transistors' thermal parallel noise of the universe. So this is delta E squared in units of kBT. This is the wave number. This is omega R, the real frequency. These are the spontaneously emitted, weakly damped, parallel, non-collective electric field fluctuations. For a thermal velocity of 10 to the minus 3, the speed of light. And then you see these blank regions here. This is just the limits that you are in the weak damping limit, and also This is the part where the phase speed is greater than the thermal speed. There's also another picture where the phase speed is lower than the thermal speed. So these are the non-collective fluctuations. And this is the dispersion relation of the Langmuir wave. So most of the fluctuations, again, sit in this close to this dispersion relation here. Now the so you start out, let's assume that we start out with the production spectrum of the pairs. And to make things easy, let's assume this is a delta function with some parallel momentum parallel to the ambient magnetic field. And as I told you, the final state of the evolution is reached when you get to the plateau, when this is dFj by dP parallel is zero. So you know in the beginning you have this beam, and in the end, if you write it, yeah, you write the plateau distribution function, no perpendicularly spread, just with the parallel thing, you have a Heaviside function. So you have a flat distribution between zero and maximum momentum p. This is when the instability will be over. Now, if you take the quasi-linear wave equation, di by dt, and you integrate it over time, you get this expression here. So the intensity at time t minus the intensity at time equals zero is the time integral of, there's the wave intensity here also showing up here, sine the gradient in the parallel distribution function. And at the same time, you write down the quasi-linear equation for g. This is the equation for g. And it involves the same Cherenkov resonance. This is essential. So the wave interaction has the same resonance condition as a quasi-linear interaction. And therefore, you can express one equation with the other. So you can look up the technical details if you're interested in the paper. So the one integral, you make a delta function in k out of it. And you do the integral. So for the time, for the particles, you get this with the delta function. You can do the k integral, and then you integrate that at a time in p parallel. You get this one. And if you do the p parallel integration in the wave equation with the delta function, so you write the delta function now as a delta function in p parallel, you get this with an index of refraction. And then you can figure out that the one term appears on the right-hand side of the other. And then you basically derive what is known as the electrostatic quasi-linear integral. The Russians have done this in the 60s for non-relativistic plasmas. This is a relativistic version of it. So the change in wave intensity at some time t, sometime zero, is always related to the particles at time zero and time t. They are related to each other at any time. So if you now would know, initially you had the beam, at finite time you have the plateau, you could calculate how much waves you will get in total. And if you do that, you insert the beam and the plateau under here. Here insert the plateau, there insert the beam. And you can do this integral. And you can calculate the fully developed electrostatic turbulence like this. So this is the spectrum at time TE of the electrostatic fluctuations that you get. N is the index of refraction, so CK over omega. So this is K, so this is the K to the minus 4 spectrum that you will get. Now you integrate this over all K, then you find out that the created energy density in electric field is given by this expression, 2 pi gamma nb mec squared. And if you calculate the change in the electric field, fluctuation energy density is 1/4 of the initial kinetic energy in the beam. Now, electrostatic waves have equipartition between electric and velocity fluctuation. So that gives you another factor of 2. So you find out that the most you can get is that 50% of the initial beam energy goes into electrostatic fluctuations. You can't get 100% because you do not destroy particles, you relocate them. So half of the initial energy density of the pair beam goes into electrostatic fluctuations from this crazy linear argument. Now the problem is, how do you find out the plateauing time scale? We just have assumed that at TE you have a plateau, but we don't know how large TE is. Now, in order to estimate that plateauing time scale, there are basically three methods. One is you do numerical simulations, you solve these two coupled equations numerically. This has been done for non-relativistic plasmas by Grognard, a problem on solar flares, and Peter Yeohn with collaborators in 2011, and this is where you find this factor 100. It takes about 100 times of the shortest growth time to get the full plateau. Now, if we just take these non-relativistic simulation results, the all relativistic one, then we would get a growth time of 2.8 years, which is comfortably much smaller than the inverse Compton time scale. Now, an upper limit, if you would like to improve on this, you would get an upper limit if you say that the only fluctuations that work back on the particle beam are the spontaneously emitted level of electrostatic fluctuations. We still want to do that calculation. A lower limit, this is how everybody does that, is now that you argue, let's assume that already at time t equals zero, the fully developed spectrum is available. This is definitely wrong, because it takes time TE to create the fully developed turbulence. But now let's assume that we have this already at time equals zero. That will give us a lower limit on this time scale. Now we know what the spectrum was. This is the spectrum as a function of k. I need three more minutes and I'm done, so don't worry. And the true relaxation time scale will be in here. Now if you do this, you get this particle kinetic equation for this normalized parallel momentum. And this is the relaxation time. If you put in the fully developed turbulence, this is the relaxation time. This goes as 1 over x squared. And at x equals 1, the time is 10 to the 12, but then it goes down by x squared. So you can ask yourself, when is this relaxation time smaller than the inverse Compton scattering time scale, 2.5 times 10 to the 6 years? And then you find out for all momenta greater than 674, this relaxation time is shorter than the inverse Compton time scale. X is of order 10 to the 6. So you affect the high energy ones by this relaxation. And you can also solve this kinetic equation. So you can express it. I mean, this is a Bessel function, I3 half. So this is also sine hyperbolic, cosine hyperbolic. So you could calculate what it is. So it's basically, if you start out with, a delta function at time equals zero. So you just, if you do this, it just as a function of time, it just evolves with time. And at the end, you have something like a plateau here. So you can do this. And this is what I mean by partial plateauing. We might be somewhere in here. Full plateauing is it's flat. No plateauing, it's the delta function. Partial plateauing, you're somewhere in here. The inverse Compton signal will be reduced, but not maybe by a factor of 10, maybe by a factor smaller. So this can be exactly done. Now you say, okay, this is only quasi-linear theory. Can we do better? We know there are also these other non-quasi-linear effects in the kinetic equation I talked about. Now the trick there to do is to introduce a factor of alpha, where alpha is the ratio of the growth time for Langmuir wave generation to any nonlinear time scale. I did this with the German Carl Sagan, Harald Lesch. So this was part of his PhD thesis. And if the growth rate, the nonlinear growth rates are much smaller than CE, then you prolong your relaxation time scale by this factor alpha TE. Because you, most of, if alpha is greater than one, then you use the majority of your electrostatic waves for doing something else. So they are no longer available for working back on the particles. Therefore, you nonlinearly stabilize the beam. And now we discussed this a little bit also in this paper. Now, this is all for parallel propagation. Now, we have to do this for oblique propagation. Nobody has done it so far. So it's a challenge. Can we also write down a quasi-linear integral for oblique electrostatic waves? And how can that be solved? And as we will hear this in the afternoon, he can also apply, by, in the talk by Stefan Krakow, you can also apply this so, to relativistic hadron beams if you have ultra-relativistic cosmic rays coming from extragalactic sources. They should also have these sort of instabilities, and they also can put in energy to the intergalactic medium. Yeah, thanks for your patience. This is all I have to say, yes.
So we probably have time for just one question. So, very interesting. A question regarding the spontaneous emitted magnetic field fluctuations. So, you actually show that they are fields emitted on skin, plasma skin depth, if I understand your argument correctly.
They are what?
On the plasma skin depth.
Yeah, they are emitted at small spatial scales, yes.
So then they say, if a shock runs over them, they get amplified.
Yes.
What about magnetic reconnection, if you basically, because the mean is zero in these fields, did you consider the non-ideal effects?
Well, magnetic... Well, I don't know. This is not, you mean turbulent reconnection?
For instance, or any reconnection process, because if you squeeze down or if you push things together, and of course they have a random distribution, you will get some annihilation, right? I mean,
well, we, of course, delta B is positive and negative, and the average is zero. So
okay.
we have a variance, delta B squared, so which itself is positive.
But I mean, there will be some dissipation mechanisms as a result of this sort of development and the evolution equations.
Yeah, that's, yeah, I have to think about it. I think what I can say there right now is there has been work on the nonlinear evolution of the Weibull fluctuations. And actually, it's the big ones eating the little ones. I mean, as Antoine said, if the fields, if you use Ampere's law, if you have two positive magnetic fields, they repel from each other, and you have negative ones, they merge to a bigger one. So that can probably be used to...
If you have free energy distribution functions, this is, I guess, work done by Phil, the big simulations, but if you look in post-Chopin regime, which is the one I was talking about,
yeah.
Relax them, if the free energy gets disappears from the system, then you get actually maybe loose, or then you get free... magnetic field strength decays over time, right?
Yeah. I think these shock simulations, they basically have a reflected particle beam upstream of the shock, and that's a necessary condition for amplification.
Yes.
And then in a nonlinear interaction, and I think Medvedev had looked into this, I think also Antoine looked into this, you make large scales out of small scales. Because you have some flux tubes repelling from each other and some flux tubes attracting each other.
But it's true that in the process the field decays. So you have kind of an inverse cascade, but the total magnetic energy is decaying.
It would correspond to an inverse cascade, yes.
Sorry,
yes.
But the field, the total energy is decayed in time quite fast.
No, you have to imagine that this, you constantly create this field because you have the spontaneous emission is steady in time. You're constantly creating.
The shock front. What
no, I'm not talking about the shock front. That's different because there you have free energy. I'm talking about this. You emit the field spontaneously and you damp them, and then you get an equilibrium. But many people say, "Oh, you create them once and then they decay," but they don't because you constantly replenish them by spontaneous emission.
Good. Any more? Any other questions, Meinhard? Thank all the morning speakers.